This is Jessica, and you're listening to the Asian Madness Podcast. Hey friends, welcome back to the Asian Madness Podcast. Again, hope you're all taking good care of yourselves and doing fun things that make you happy. Unless it's something illegal, then you probably shouldn't do it. Anyway, on to today's case. I don't know about you, but I feel like a lot of people out there tend to have types of cases that they are more interested in. Perhaps it's crimes of passion. Or maybe some of you are heavily into unsolved crimes. While it can get frustrating not knowing the truth behind a case, the speculating and putting the pieces together part can be very intriguing. Or some of you might dislike unsolved cases, because not knowing is extremely disturbing. One type of crime that tends to stay with me more so than others are filicides, where parents kill their children. There's the case of Andrea Yates, who killed five of her kids. Or more recently, in 2024, a man in Ohio shot and killed three of his kids. What drives a parent to do that? Someone who's supposed to be protecting the kids. Today, we will be touching on a case like that, where a man commits a terrible crime, claiming four lives. While he never had the best background and upbringing, it cannot excuse his actions, and I can't imagine how it could. This is the case involving a man named Lam Luong. What happens when a seemingly ordinary immigrant family becomes the center of a crime that defies all comprehension, leaving the only survivors haunted and heartbroken for the rest of their lives? As a warning, this episode will involve violence against children. If this is not for you, please feel free to take a break. I know we cover a lot of those stories here on this podcast, but this one may be particularly disturbing to some because we're looking at a case where the people who are supposed to love and protect you are the culprits. And I should also mention, there are multiple victims here. If you're still listening, then let's begin. Today's case takes us to the city of Mobile in the southern state of Alabama. I believe this is the first time I venture into Alabama in my podcast. Situated along the Alabama Gulf Coast, Mobile is a blend of rich history and modern vibrancy. But beyond all that, it is also a bustling economic center, anchored by a strategic port and a diverse range of industries, from aerospace to manufacturing. This city was also home to the Luong family, Lam and Q Fun, along with their four children. Lam Luong was born in Vietnam around the year 1970, which was also during the time of the Vietnam War. He was born to a Vietnamese woman and a Black American serviceman, which defined most of his childhood. Something that we see a lot from these types of wars is an abundance of mixed-race children with a military father from another country. In this case, the United States, and a local mother, a Vietnamese woman in this case. While some of these children are the result of cross-cultural relationships, there are also plenty others who are born from rape, or in other cases, a mother working as a sex worker. This can cause a lot of confusion for the child, as most soldiers end up returning to the United States after the war, meaning these kids would never see their biological father. In a study done on this, the author mentioned the Amerasian Homecoming Act of 1987. Quote, "To be eligible for the Amerasian Homecoming Act, a mixed-race child must be born in Vietnam after January 1st, 1962, and before January 1, 1976. Documents to be submitted to the U.S. consulate. The request is considered in the case of mixed children, stating full name, date of birth, and place of birth of the applicant, full name and date of birth of the biological U.S. father, if known, the current address of household registration and address of the applicant. Explain the specific reason why the applicant believes that he is mixed race. Information about the circumstances and time that the biological father and mother of the applicant met. Attach a copy of any evidence, if any, unquote. So basically, if you were a mixed race child born during or right after the war, and you believe your father was an American soldier, you would have a pathway to immigration to the United States, as it's technically where your father's from, whether he is involved in your life or not. Just a bit of information that I found interesting and somewhat relevant to this episode. So back to Lam Wong. Not too much information is available on his life, but here's what we have. Lam had a difficult time growing up and could not attend school because of discrimination against Black Americans at the time. His identity, understandably, was a source of a lot of discrimination in his early life by his teachers, his peers, and even his stepfather, who used to regularly beat him. Many people seem to love to romanticize the idea of mixed-race people, sometimes to a point where it's almost a fetish. This is my personal take based on my experience, so it may not reflect how you feel. I've come across Asians who will tell you that mixed-race babies are much cuter and they will obsess over the idea of having mixed-race babies themselves, especially half-white, half-Asian babies. This is honestly a complicated topic, not something I can just gloss over in two sentences. So let's just say, racism is definitely a thing. As I mentioned, Lam's father was a Black man, so obviously he himself was half-Black. When he was just 14 years old, desperation took hold, and he managed to run away to Alabama, all the way from Vietnam. According to his records, which were uncovered later on, he had obtained refugee status to get to the U.S., but had not bothered to apply for citizenship. Once Lam arrived in Alabama, he found himself a place in the church basement and lived there for a while before moving in with a local family and becoming independent at the age of 16. To support himself, he worked on a shrimp boat in Mississippi, where things only became more difficult. I can empathize with that, being judged all your life for something you cannot control, then managing to carve out an identity and a place for yourself in a completely foreign land. It's a lot, and it isn't wild if he experienced a lot of trauma due to this. So it's also no surprise that Lam found some escapism in drugs and alcohol. He became addicted to cocaine and would spend all of his earnings on drugs and sex. At this point, whatever helped him take the pain away, he would go for it. It was later during this phase of his life where he met Kyu Pan in 2004, who later became his wife. Not much is known of how they met except the fact that they met in Alabama, but we know that Kyu was already pregnant with her first unborn son, Ryan, when she met Lam. But that did not matter to Lam. He decided to stick around and raise Ryan as his own. The couple went on to father three more children in rapid succession, Hannah, Lindsay, and Danny. It's also worth mentioning that Kyu at this time was only around 19 when they met, while Lam was around 34. I know this might feel rather predatory as she's barely an adult and he's in his mid-30s, I would think that Lam had a lot of unresolved and ongoing issues, so dating someone almost half his age was not going to be something that would keep him up at night. After their marriage, they lived with Kyu's mother in the city of Bayou-Labatry for a while. This was a fishing village 20 miles southwest of Mobile. Lam was determined to earn a good living by himself to support his family, so he continued to work on shrimp boats for a considerable amount of time. Things were going well for him and his family, tucked away in a fishing village. Maybe he tried to get past his trauma, his issues, maybe even tried to get clean. all for the sake of his new family. But in 2005, Hurricane Katrina destroyed that village, leaving Lam unemployed and his family essentially homeless. But honestly, by that point, Lam had overcome far worse problems. So they picked up the pieces of what was left and relocated about 400 miles east to Hinesville, Georgia, a city located on the Atlantic coastal plain. Q managed to find a job as a nail technician at a local nail salon, but Lam had more trouble not just finding work, but staying employed. He started out working at a car wash, then moved on to a restaurant. For whatever reason, he was soon fired, and Lam found more difficulty finding employment. Eventually, he gave in to the pressure and relapsed, going back to drugs and alcohol as a coping mechanism. He was battling a drug addiction, and he knew it. He even called the police on himself in October of 2007 in the hopes that they would help him. When the police arrived, they found that he was in possession of crack cocaine, and since it was a felony, he was taken into custody. He was quickly released, though, on a $1,200 bond 2 days later. Not just that, he somehow got a new girlfriend on the side, despite living with Q as a family. Lam does give off very destructive vibes. While I agree he's had a lot of hardship throughout his life, no one can really help him unless he helps himself first. But he's not just destroying his life, he's also harming those around him, as in Q and his children. Q knew that if she wanted to protect her children, she would have to get away from Lam, as far as she possibly could. So in November of 2007, she packed up her things, grabbed her kids, and moved back to Mobile, Alabama to stay with her mother. But Lam was nothing if not persistent. He showed up in Mobile as well, begging to be taken back, and began to follow Q around wherever she went. Not sure if she took him back for her own sake, or more likely for the sake of her kids. Lam attempted to find a job for a while before giving up and living on Q's small salary. He had not broken up with the other girlfriend he had either, as he continued to beg both women for money to fund his drug habit. Overall, it's just a very sad situation. Lam clearly had a lot of baggage, and I wouldn't be surprised to know if Q, his wife, also had a difficult childhood and life. She was so young, living with an unstable man way older than her, and not to mention, she also had to take care of her kids. This can be a recipe for disaster, and that's exactly what happened. Let's fast forward a bit to January 7th of 2008. Q is 23 years old, and Lam is around 38. Lam was behaving erratically during the day, which was concerning for Q. In the morning, he went to see her at her place of employment to ask for some money. He claimed he needed the money for gasoline for their van. Once he got the money, he then left and disappeared for a few hours. This was not particularly unusual, but when Q got home after work, she also found her four kids missing, and Lam wasn't answering his phone. Maybe part of her was like, the kids are probably out with dad, but taking four kids by yourself is a lot of work. And part of her definitely felt uncomfortable of the idea. She kept trying for hours until he finally picked up, but to her shock, he said the kids were not with him. He claimed they were with some other woman, a woman Q did not know. According to him, the woman would bring the kids back home by nighttime, but his tone did not seem believable. He seemed distracted, disturbed, unsure, which, of course, did nothing to calm Q's nerves. And when this random mysterious woman did not show up at the time Lam promised, Q went straight to the police. She reported all four of her kids missing. Hannah, who was 2 years old, Lindsay, who was a 1 year old, Ryan, 3 years old, and Danny, just 4 months old. Just four little babies. And since they were so young, and all four children had gone missing together, the entire city had their eyes peeled, keeping an eye out for these four kids. The police started going door to door asking neighbors if they had seen the kids, or the mystery woman who supposedly had the kids, but no one could tell them anything. Everyone, from the neighbors to random civilians, wanted to help find these kids. But there really wasn't much they could tell the police. As a side note, this part of the case reminds me of another case that took place in Michigan. The parents of three boys were in the process of getting a divorce when one day after Thanksgiving, the father did not return with the three kids as he was supposed to. When his wife asked him where her kids were at, he told her he gave them to a woman named Joanne to keep them safe. Sounds familiar, right? The police became involved, and while this case took place in 2010, the three boys have never been seen since. If they had been murdered by their father, their bodies were never discovered either. While it is widely believed that their father, John, killed the three kids, they were never able to prove this as they had no bodies. This man was ultimately sentenced to 10 to 15 years for unlawful imprisonment, and since this case took place in 2010, well, it's 2025 now. He could be free this year. Anyway, back to Lam and Q. The next day, Lam claimed that the mystery woman's name was Kim, but he could not provide any more details as to where she had gone or where they had met, probably because Kim did not exist. This inconsistency in statements made him a viable suspect for the police. Even at home, his family feared that he might have traded the kids for some cash, which is vile, but also not unheard of. This is an insane thing to think of, so we have to acknowledge that the family must have seen some really heartbreaking moments to even consider this. But if the kids were last with him, isn't this the logical conclusion? And let's not forget how shady he was being with this Kim woman. Yes, it was just speculation at the moment, but even speculation has some basis, some foundation. And Lam must have been a pretty terrible father in his drunk or high state to be accused of such a thing. The accusations must have been pretty strong because Lam was soon taken into custody. Before the interrogation began, he told the police that he wanted to speak to his wife first. He was granted that request, and he talked to her for 4 minutes in Vietnamese, after which Q was left crying hysterically. The investigators were not yet aware of what they had talked about, but it didn't seem to be good news. After taking a moment, Q informed the police that Lam had just said, quote, "No one will ever find those kids because they are already dead," unquote. While shocking to have him admit this, it wasn't entirely shocking considering his actions and behavior, and it also confirmed that Lam knew exactly what had happened, because, obviously, he was responsible for it. Captain Darrell Wilson of the police department asked Lam where the children were, and he said he could guide them to where the children had been left. When in the police car, he said they should drive to Dauphin Island Bridge. The captain was shocked to hear that and went on to ask, quote, "Do you mean to tell me that you threw your four children off the top of the Dauphin Island Bridge?" Unquote. To this, he just said, "Yes." When asked why he would do something like this, he said, quote, "Ask my family, they know why." Unquote. I really can't imagine there could be a good reason to do this, but in the mind of someone like Lam, it probably made sense. The next day, Lam withdrew his statement and again claimed the existence of a woman named Kim, who took the kids. His lawyer argued that the earlier confession was forced by the police and that Lam had nothing to do with whatever happened to the kids. By this point, though, it was obvious Lam was trying to get out of this confession because absolutely nobody in the precinct had forced him to say anything. But on top of that, they also had witnesses that placed Lam on the bridge at 9 a.m. on the morning of January 7, 2008. They told police that they had seen him throwing something in the river, which to them only appeared to be bags of trash. Throwing trash into a river is definitely not good for the environment and not something you see every day, so it makes sense that people who were around took note of this and remembered. Not sure if anyone went up to him to tell him to not do that, but it doesn't seem like anyone did. So the police began to search for the kids, starting at the place he had taken them, Dauphin Island Bridge. Several divers and helicopters were recruited to comb the area, but they found nothing. not in the water, and not on the surrounding land. The investigators were considering the possibility that the bodies might not be here because the water currents might have taken them away. So the police doubled down. They recruited more people and expanded the area of the search, and even locals and families joined in. I'm sure nobody wanted to be the one to find these lifeless bodies, but they also understood the gravity of the situation. After 5 days of exhaustive searching, the first body was found. Danny, the four-month-old baby, was found. Reports stated that he died due to blunt force trauma, as well as drowning, which really means that he was thrown from the bridge and landed in the water while he was still alive. But his little body could not survive the current he was thrown into, and he passed away. The chances of an adult surviving this is not 100%, let alone a tiny little baby. And then more bodies were discovered. Ryan, the eldest of the four kids, was found next in Barton Bay, a few miles west of where Danny was found. Then Lindsay's body was found. And finally, on January 20th, Hannah's body was found in Venice, Louisiana, about 140 miles from where she was thrown. The search was officially over after Hannah's body was found, and the case against Lamb was stacking up. Not that the authorities needed any more proof, but it was clear Lamb had committed these murders. The statements given by Lamb throughout the case had been very conflicting. He started claiming that a mysterious woman had his children, then to having killed them, and then again back to the woman. This was before the bodies of all four kids were recovered. After they were found, Lamb again claimed that he was responsible, and he requested the death sentence from the court. In a letter to the judge, he said, quote, "Dear Judge, my name is Lam Wong. I am plead guilty for that I have done that was the matter of killing my four children. From the day they die, I no longer want to live, but I don't know how to die. Just please grant my wish. I hereby request the death penalty as soon as possible. That is my request. Lam Wong," unquote. That's as clear as a confession can get, right? Well, during the jury selection process, Lam once again withdrew his confession and pleaded not guilty. The trial began on March 16, 2009, before which there were several attempts by Lam's lawyer to delay the proceedings. The first witness who spoke at the trial was Q, and it was the first of many heartbreaking testimonies. Not that it affected Lam in any way. According to the people in court, the man showed zero emotions as his wife broke down crying, talking about the death of her kids. No guilt, no remorse, no emotion. In her testimony, Q revealed that their relationship was affected by their relocation to Hinesville after Hurricane Katrina. She brought up Lam's history of infidelity and drug abuse, which contributed to their strained relationship. She told the court that Lam was not a good father or provider, and he depended on the money he took from Q and her family. She also mentioned that the reason they moved back to Alabama was due to his drug use and affairs. When she found out about it, she took the kids and moved back to their hometown. Lam followed them to make amends, but more likely to milk more cash for his drug addiction. One of the worst moments of her testimony was when Lam had told her her kids were not coming back, which was followed by uncontrollable laughter. How he found this funny is beyond me. Q went on to state how Lam was finding it hard to find a job once they returned to Alabama, and his instability only increased with each passing day. It's almost like a vicious cycle. He is troubled, so it's hard to find work and stay employed, and when he has a job, he is inconsistent due to his addiction and troubles, so he lets go. On and on it goes. After all these statements and evidence presented against Lam, his lawyer tried to argue that since he had no history of violence, his charge should be dropped to manslaughter. He claimed that Lam had snapped at that moment, and that his depression and drug use were possible reasons for his unimaginable act. Of course, rehabilitation was an option suggested for Lam, but the prosecutor argued that he should be given the death penalty for what he had put those children and his family through. His point was that Lam chose to do drugs, still had plenty of time to clean up and be a good father, but actively chose otherwise. And the judge, as well as the jury, seemed to agree with this. Listen, as someone with no drug or alcohol dependency, it is extremely difficult for me to imagine being in his shoes. I now know that it is never that simple. There are so many reasons why people turn to drugs and alcohol, not to mention that there are studies showing that some people have a higher risk of becoming addicts. While it's not completely their fault, it can be recognized as something to actively work towards. But for someone like Lam, it was probably never that easy. He did not have the best upbringing. He definitely suffered abuse. But is it an excuse for his actions? I would say no. Judge Charles Gradix said that his actions were voluntary and that he could not blame them for being the result of his upbringing or ethnicity. He also mentioned and emphasized the pain and fear the children must have felt as they fell from the bridge at the hands of their own father. So after being declared guilty, he was sentenced to death by lethal injection. In his final remark in the court, he said, quote, "I apologize to my wife," unquote. But wait, we're not done yet. When Lam was handed the death penalty, Q and her family had hoped the worst part of their lives was now behind them. Justice, in their eyes, was finally served, and Lam was about to get the death he deserved. I know many people are vehemently opposed to capital punishment, but in this case, the children's mother and family were in agreement that this had to be done. But to their dismay, the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals overturned his conviction and death sentence. And the reason, you ask? Media saturation and the judge's refusal to move the trial away from Mobile County. But how does any of that matter, you wonder? Well, it's possible that the media coverage of the case influenced public opinion and the jury pool, so it affected their judgment and therefore the sentencing. It's common for trials of this magnitude to be moved away from where it took place, because it is very likely everyone and their mother knows what happened. The judge's refusal to relocate the trial away from Mobile County, where the crime and media coverage was most intense, could have compromised the fairness of the trial. Once you hear about something like this, can you say you will remain impartial and only focus on what is presented at the trial? I don't really think so. Let's pretend Lam had beat up someone almost to death prior to killing his kids. You found out about it from the media, but it was never brought up in court. There is no way your brain will actively dismiss this piece of knowledge that you already have. Once you know it, you can't unknow it, and it will very likely influence your take when making your decision as a jury member. I know this might sound frustrating to some of you, but let me clarify. He wasn't let out or anything. His sentencing was changed from death to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. This decision was made after several assessments, which concluded that Lam met the criteria for intellectual disability with an IQ score of 51. And according to the Eighth Amendment, involving cruel and excessive punishment, you cannot execute a criminal under such conditions. In 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court also ruled it unconstitutional to execute people who are intellectually disabled. I am pro-rehabilitation and for providing mental health services for convicted criminals like Lam, but I can see why Q and her family were not immediately on board with this change. This new sentence came as a shock to the family, as well as the people involved in the first trial, because this aspect had gone completely undiscussed. There was no mention of intellectual disability by the family or even by Lam himself. But the court upheld this new decision, sparing Lam from the death penalty. And with that, the case came to an end. An unsatisfactory end, according to some, and especially Q, I imagine. The district attorney, Ashley Rich, said, quote, "Our hands are tied. No one deserves the death penalty more than the man who on January 7th, 2008, lived a normal life and showed no signs of below average IQ, Colden calculatedly threw his four children off the Dauphin Island Bridge, unquote. To this day, Lamb has not revealed what exactly happened on the morning of January 7, 2008, that drove him to drown and kill his children. So the families of these kids have to deal with this horrible incident without ever knowing. Why? Could it be due to financial stress? Having kids meant more expenses, and I don't think Q and Lamb had all the money in the world to spend on fun things, like drugs, I guess, in Lamb's case. Or was he under the influence of drugs, which clouded his judgment? Unless Lamb wants to provide more information, it's difficult to say what his reasoning was for killing four little kids. Although he did tell police that his family knew the reason, I doubt Q could come up with something logical either. After all, most of us believe that parents are meant to protect, provide, and love their kids. So there you have it. The case of a man who murdered not one, not two, but four of his kids, then disposing of their bodies. Not even behind closed doors, mind you, but in broad daylight, in front of multiple witnesses. The case of Lam Luong is a haunting reminder of the fragility of life and the unpredictable nature of human behavior. It leaves us questioning how tragedy can strike, even in the most unexpected circumstances, and by the people we should be able to trust most in the world. Lam and Q's loved ones and acquaintances knew of his drug habits and occasional erratic behavior, but no one could have anticipated such a tragedy. I feel deeply for Q and her family. Losing a family member, even when it's a natural cause, can already be difficult enough to deal with. But this takes it to a whole different level. Not sure if Q may have felt some type of guilt, like being their mother, she was unable to protect them from this man. But could she have known this would happen? I don't think so. Wherever she is, I hope she's healing and handling her trauma. There's probably never going to be real closure for her, but hopefully she can live well knowing this monster won't be bothering her ever again. So, yeah, heavy stuff. If you've made it this far, thank you for sticking around. No one likes to hear about kids getting murdered, so understandable if this one was difficult. Please remember to be kind to others. Seek help when you need it. It's not a weakness. It shows recognition and understanding. That's a strength. Trying to become a better person should never be seen as a weakness. Please take care of yourselves, and till next time.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.